Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Later in today's program, we'll talk with Michael Grooms, founder and director of SMAG Dance Collective in Dayton, about how they're bridging gaps between artists, arts organizations, and audiences. Up first, news that caused a lot of people to reflect on the past and their love and respect for the legendary Pete Seeger, who died a week ago Monday. The following day, filmmaker Julia Reichert sat down in the studio with Nikki Dakota to remember the musician and share audio from her interviews with him. Here's a good portion of that conversation.
And when these fingers can strum no longer, and the old banjo to young ones stronger, play that harp.
You know, we've been thinking this day was going to come, especially ever since his wife Toshi passed on recently. And it's a very sad day for all of us. It's certainly a sad day for me. I did bring along some clips that feature Pete as singing, his speaking. The clips I'm bringing are from a film that my partner Jim Klein and I made called Seeing Red, which is also called Stories of American Communists.
Released in 1984.
Released in 1984, yeah. But I will say, I just was remembering this, Nikki. I'm just going to throw this in, because the very first time I actually met Pete in person was in 1976 in the Victory Theater in Dayton, Ohio.
Some people know it as Victoria, but it was
Victory
first.
It was the
Victory
Theater, and that was when the ceiling was falling in, and it was, you know, not a great place. And it was the night we had the world premiere of our film Union Maids, a much earlier film. And it was May Day. It happened to be the last day of April. The next day was May Day. Pete was in town to do a concert at Wright State, I think. Lo and behold, he shows up in the theater. This icon. I mean, he was incredibly popular at that point. He shows up in the theater. And of course, all throughout Union Maids is Pete's music, aww, which we had never asked for permission to use. It's the Almanac Singers. You know, in those days, you just put it in. So there he is in the back. And I'm watching him, and he's singing along. Mm. You know, we got to roll the union on. He's singing along. And at the end, I sort of meekly approached him, and I said, Mr. Seeger, I hope you don't mind. We used your music without asking
so very
you.
Much of your great music.
And he had already written a quote, and he'd signed it with his banjo, which he always signs. He had already written a quote for us because he knew we would need it. Like, it says, this film will go down as a classic and will be seen by millions around the world or something. He had already handwritten it out, and he
what
said here.
What a thoughtful man.
I know. And then he had his banjo with him, and then he left. Wow. So that was the first time I met him. But then later, when we were going to make the film Seeing Red, which was, you know, much bigger national film and took years to make and all that, we always kind of thought that maybe Pete Seeger had been in the Communist Party. It was never said publicly. We didn't really know. We knew he was kind of a leftist and affiliated, and he and Woody Guthrie sang at rallies and Communist Party events and all that, but we just didn't know. So we went to see him in Poughkeepsie, up where he lived, up on a mountainside above the Hudson River. A handmade house, you know, heated by wood. They grew their own greens. They grew their own everything. It was amazing because
one of this where he walks the walk. It's not just this. Yeah.
Well, that's one thing we realized about Pete is it's not just that he went out and sang protest songs or, you know, he appeared at things and he spoke on the right side of anti-racism and for working people. But the way he lived his life, he was one of the first people I met in my life. And I was young then. I mean, I was in my 20s when we met him. I was actually pregnant with my daughter, Leela, at that point. So that's got to be maybe around 30. And the way that everything in the Seeger household, he and Toshi, was made by hand. Like the bowl you ate out of, maybe not the spoon, but the glass, the napkins, they were all made by artisans. Mm. Some Toshi. Toshi was a wonderful potter. And they grew their own greens. They had a toilet that composted. I'm talking about, you know, in the late 70s. He chopped his own wood. They lived off the land. And there were always like a million people up there, children. Other musicians were always coming in and out of the house, sitting down to play. And Pete would just get his banjo and play with them. And whether they were from Africa or Brazil, they would always come up. So I have such warm memories of Pete as a person, you know. And, of course, he's a very gentle man, very gentle and quiet, very philosophical, but he was fierce and strong as anything when he was standing up for justice, whether it was standing up against a racist, whether it was standing up against cops, whether it was standing up against the House on American Activities Committee, which I have a clip which we'll play in a minute about that. He was amazing fighter for justice. First and foremost, though, he, to me, was a musician and a singer. That was his real love.
Yeah, you have a clip here that is actually has to do with a journalist is making a report on.
Yeah, this is from the film Seeing Red. It comes in kind of early on when we're kind of setting the scene of what the 1930s and early 40s were like in America. That's when a lot of people joined the American Communist Party because they saw it as the only organization that was kind of standing up to the really rough conditions of that time, you know, the Depression, people being thrown out of their homes. In this case, in Missouri, a lot of sharecroppers who were primarily African-American were basically starving because they didn't actually own their land and they had to give up their crops to the owner.
So sharecropper is really the owner of the land always takes a share of the crops and is, in fact, the lion's share.
Right. And if you had a bad year because of weather or whatever, you could really be left with nothing. It's really kind of another form of slavery, basically. So sharecroppers, and so they, as a protest, they brought all their belongings and put them out along a road in Missouri. Okay, so this journalist, you're going to hear his voice first, talks about going down there from Chicago to cover this story. And you know, he's one of the characters in our film. And he talks about seeing the sharecroppers, seeing them cooking in, outdoors in the winter, seeing the little kids really skinny and crying because of lack of food. And he's talking about what this looked like to him. So you'll see his last, you'll hear his last few words. And then we added a song that Pete sings, which is called "I Don't Want Your Millions, Mister. I just want to be able to raise my kids and to feed my kids. That's all I want. I don't want your millions." So that song seemed very appropriate. And he sang it for us at his cabin in near Poughkeepsie, New York. So why don't we just play that clip? You're going to hear Carl Hirsch, the journalist's voice first.
"By intervals, this thing has ripped the heart out of me and inspired me as few things ever have. It's the colossal guts of these people. Bucking a setup as cruel and hidebound, as ruthless and powerful as the planter autocracy. It's a story that I'll tell you for weeks if I ever get back.
I don't want your millions, mister. I don't want your diamond ring. All I want, just the right to live, mister. Give me back my job again. I know you have the land deed, mister. The money is all in your name. But where's the work that you did, mister? I'm demanding back my job again. So I don't want your millions, mister. I don't want your diamond ring. All I want, just the right to live, mister.
Give me back my job again.
Think me dumb if you wish, mister. Call me green or blue or red."
The communists had an impact on the shape of their era. Many reforms we take for granted today were first brought to public attention by the Communist Party and the thousands of men and women who worked with them.
Well, and that voice, the last voice, is our guest in studio today, one of the co-producers of the film Seeing Red, Stories of American Communists from 1984, and that was actually seen. Audio selection from that movie. We're in the studio today with Julia Reichert, who spent some good time with Pete in the course of making this movie and in another setting as well. And you can't read very far into Pete's bio without running up against communism and the forces that were at work in this country at the time that painted this as the most evil, you know, that communism was out to destroy the very fabric of this country. Mm-hmm. And as we all know, this roughly from 1950 to 56, when McCarthy was bringing people in front of the American or un-American, what was it? The
House Un-American Activities Committee.
Un-American.
HUAC, right. Un-American Activities Committee.
It?
And we're going to. In a second, we're going to hear I have a couple of clips from Pete about that. I just wanted to mention, though, that, you know, you heard my voice there at the end saying the Communist Party fought for things that we now consider commonplace. I just wanted to mention so people know what he means. What I mean is they fought for the 8-hour day. They fought for unemployment insurance, which was unheard of then. They fought for Social Security. They fought for equal treatment for people of color, which was very much unheard of then. They fought for just unions. They fought for unions to be part of the American life. And so we in the film, we have lots of clips and so forth about that. It feels so familiar to now how many people, I think, feel about what's going on in the economy, the income inequality. So Pete and those folks were really onto something. But let's go on, because you mentioned about HUAC and the House Un-American Activities Committee. Let's just hear a little, because, you know, Pete was called up. A lot of people were called up. But let's hear what he says, that he's going to quote his friend Woody Guthrie and sing a song. He's sort of in the middle of our interview. He would sort of grab his banjo because he was first a musician.
And music was a part of his life.
Absolutely.
It wasn't something that was just for performance. It was one of the planks upon which he built his existence.
And when he would do an interview, you had to have the banjo right next to him because he would just pick it up and illustrate the point as he does right here. So let's hear that. Okay.
Flashed a badge at me. He says, "Mr. Seeger, I'm from the FBI. I wonder if you'd like to talk to us about the communist conspiracy." I just smiled, said, "No, thanks." I suppose I could have gotten off some good retorts, like, "I don't know about any conspiracy or anything." Woody Guthrie got off the greatest line. I visited Woody, and he wrote a song about it. The FBI comes and knocks on his door. And Woody says, "And I being so foolish, I let him in. They asked, would I fight for my country? I answered the FBI, yay. I will point a gun for my country, but I won't guarantee you which way. I won't guarantee you which way. I won't guarantee you which way. I will point a gun for my country, but I won't guarantee you which way."
So he and Woody, of course, were great friends. They traveled the country singing it on picket lines and at meetings and writing songs together. I mean, the lyrics to Union Mates, the song that we use in our second film, they wrote apparently together in the back of a union hall when some of the women said, "Hey, what about us?" You know, so they wrote a song, Union Mates. So the next clip is another. At a more quiet moment, we asked Pete directly when he was called up before the House Un-American Activities Committee. It's actually the House Committee on Un-American Activities. But anyway, it's interesting. Most of the communists or people who had been to a meeting even, you know, people lost their job just because they were called before the committee.
Mm-hmm.
Like if it was out,
careers
that you were
ruined.
That was it. And even if you only ever once went to a meeting, you never signed a card. But even if you signed a card, even if you were a member, isn't that allowed in America to be a member of an organization?
Yeah.
So anyway, most people did what they call took the fifth. They said, "I will not answer this question because it might incriminate me."
Yeah.
Pete took a different tack, which he sort of explains it. But he said, "This whole line of questioning is wrong. So I'm not even going to deal with this." He didn't take the fifth. He took, a higher plane of answer. So he'll explain it in a minute here.
Most of the people they called up before them declined to cooperate. They used the Fifth Amendment, which in effect says, "You have no right to ask me this question." But I was in a much stronger position. I didn't have any job they could fire me from. I sang at schools and camps for people who didn't care much for this committee. I simply said, "I think your whole line of questioning is something that no American should be forced to undergo, especially under threat of reprisal if they give the wrong answer." I said, "I have a right to my opinion, you have a right to your opinion." And from then I clammed up. And after about an hour, they gave up on me.
Pete Seeger passed away last night in his home in New York at the age of 94. We had a lot of good years with Pete Seeger. He came from a musical family. His father and mother, both musicians of great note, and also
his sister, yeah, mm-hmm.
collectors of music.
Collectors of music, absolutely. And whenever you were up there visiting, the place was full of music and full of musical instruments of all kinds. And he collected globally. I mean, he had friends and he collected music globally. There's a wonderful book called How Can I Keep From Singing? How Could I Keep From Singing, I think. It's by David Dunaway, and it's actually the story of Pete Seeger. It's a terrific book. It came out in the early 80s, so there's a lot more to be said. I will throw in, this is just a kind of a funny thing. When we first went to see Pete, we stayed several days, and we interviewed him a couple times and filmed him chopping wood and filmed him around his place, but we never got up the courage to ask him if he was actually in the Communist Party. We referred to the movement and we referred to, all that. And he didn't say, and we didn't ask. And so we left that feeling, and it was our first interview for the film. When we went back, like close to 5 years later, and I'm going to play you at the end, we'll play something that the very last thing we filmed for the movie, because he was the first thing we filmed and the last thing we filmed 6 years apart. David's book had come out, David Dunaway's book, How Could I Keep From Singing? And in that book, he finally says, yes, yes. And in the beginning of our film, he says, I think it's time to put my cards on the table. So he kind of comes out as a communist. He did. He just didn't want to. It wasn't like he was embarrassed to say or whatever. He just didn't feel that should be a big issue, So that was him. So yes, he gathered music. Yes, he was a great friend to musicians. He mentored generations of musicians. Right. And that's what I got from Pete. Is like he's just a lifelong activist who lived his beliefs. And that as a young person, that really left a big impression on me and on everybody who worked on the film.
You know it's darkest before the dawn. This thought keeps me moving on. If we could heed these early warnings, the time is now, quite early morning. If we could heed these early warnings, the time is now, quite early morning.
Filmmaker Julia Reichert sharing her memories of Pete Seeger, who died last Monday. You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Michael Grooms is the founder and artistic director for SMAG Dance Collective in Dayton. The organization is about to celebrate their 10th anniversary. I spoke to Michael about what's taken place in those 10 years and what the group is all about.
SMAG Dance Collective is a contemporary dance company that incorporates fusion forms of dance, such as hip-hop, African dances, East and West African, and some South African dances, because there's a different style in South Africa. We also have Latin dances, salsas, tangos, there's capoeira that we incorporate, and we also involve some of the other ballroom kind of movements that you would see as well. So what we do is try to take the contemporary form of dance training, which is a combination of modern dance, ballet, and jazz dance, and trying to make it a little more entertaining for the general public by adding in some of those other ethnic and social forms of movement. We started the company 10 years ago, and when I started the company, it was really more of a challenge I had made to myself that by the time my sons, which is who the company is named after, turned 12 years old, I would have a company in their name. I thought it would be a Fortune 500 company. Unfortunately, it wasn't. But fortunately, it did become something that I've spent the better part of my life doing, which is dancing, and it's a dance company.
So SMAG is an acronym?
SMAG is an acronym, yes. SM for Sean Michael. He's my youngest son. And the G in it is for Gavin. So Sean Michael and Gavin. That's the name of my sons.
Oh, great. So you've been around for 10 years, and I noticed part of your mission is to, quote, bridge the gap between artists arts organizations and the community. Tell me a little bit about those gaps that you perceive and why you want to close them.
Well, when I started this, at the time I started, it really was not a lot of collaborative effort going on. I mean, collaboration was kind of a new buzzword, per se, that arts groups were kicking around, because ultimately grant makers were interested in artists collaborating. Ultimately, they want to get more bang for the buck. So in thinking about that, I was like, you know, here in Dayton, for whatever reason, we have a lot of arts going on, but we don't have a lot of collaboration amongst the artists. So to that end, my thought process was to incorporate other, shall we say, non-traditional collaborators in the arts. And we've had, like, clothes designers who have actually designed clothes on stage that the dancers wore while they were performing. We've had painters on stage working with us that actually painted and interacted with the dancers while painting a giant canvas, spoken word artists, and, of course, the typical collaboration that dancers would have with musicians and music groups. And the aspect of providing a bridge between these groups is to set up as multiple and many collaborative efforts as possible. And then to correlate with that, I wanted to also say, let's get into the audience and give the audience something that they can understand, because it got to a place where I think that you pretty much had to have a PhD in fine art in order to really understand what was going on stage, because it had just got so out there that, you know, audiences were just kind of like showing up and paying their money and clapping, because there's a gratuitous moment. You're supposed to clap and then you leave and go home. And as opposed to leaving with that experience, I thought that it would be nicer to incorporate them. And so that's the idea of trying to bridge the gap between the audiences and the dancers and arts organizations, so that it's not just performing at them, but performing for them and with them.
What kind of response have you had from those different groups, say artists or painters or designers, stepping into the dance world? What kind of experiences, or what have they relayed to you afterwards?
Well, you know, it's been a very, very wonderful experience, in fact, that a lot of them really appreciated. Of course, initially, they were all like, well, how do I fit into this? How do we combine the two, because it's not a normal pairing that takes place. And, you know, when we finally got to the place of being able to show how we could make it happen, the reaction has been very positive. A lot of we've done a lot of work with them. There's Mike Elsa from here in Dayton. He's got Color of Energy Art Galleries. We've done a lot of work with him. You know, he's really enjoyed and appreciated. There's another clothes designer. His name is Lamore. He's gotten involved, and actually he used to be a former dancer himself, so when it came to him, it really wasn't a big sale for him as much as it was just getting it in there and saying, okay, what are we going to do? And then when the idea came out, which we created this dance work called Fashion Show Piece, and boom, it went nuts. People really enjoyed it, and it was a great experience. The audience really got a kick out of watching him work and create this design, because they couldn't wait to see what was going to come off the sewing machine when he got finished. While they were watching us, they were slipping moot watches to watching him at the same time, and sometimes he'd get up and go and measure a dancer, you know, and the dancer would pause in the middle of moving and get measured and catch up with the rest of the dancers and keep on going. So it was really a interesting experience for audience members, and for the artists themselves, it was definitely an experience that they were like, oh, wow, I would love to do this again.
You've got an interesting take on some seasonal events like an Urban Nutcracker and Smagmare in October. Tell us about those.
The idea was to start creating some programming that we could market and sell. And so the start of that came with an Urban Nutcracker back in 2008. And the idea of Urban Nutcracker was to take the traditional concept of Nutcracker and modernize it as well as urbanize it. And we picked an urban setting because we felt like an urban setting was more of an inclusive environment than what the traditional Nutcracker brings to the table. And we don't mean to say that that is excluding individuals, but just the nature of it itself tends to exclude certain demographics and so forth that wouldn't mind coming to see it if it was presented in a different manner, hence the reason that we created Urban Nutcracker. So we've modernized it by using popular songs, R&B, hip-hop, rock and roll. There's gospel in it. There's all kinds of different diverse music artists for the soundtrack. And then the movement, of course, is our style of movement being contemporary based, but we've also included hip-hop in it and house dancing, which is called jacking, up in Chicago area. So, you know, it's been a very popular show. And if you looked at our audience base, it was probably a very recognizable mix of what the U.S. Census considers for the city of Dayton, which is practically close to a 50-50 mix of people in there. And then the other groups that are starting to show a stronger presence in the area, they were represented just as well. So you looked in our audience, and it was pure diversity, which is an incredible feeling to see that.
You began your dance career in 1982.
Yeah, back in the Stone Ages.
Yeah, starting under Geraldine Blunden, and then you became a member of the Dayton Contemporary Dance Company.
At that time, in the early 80s, there was a lot of football players, professional football players, that were making headlines for taking dance classes. And some of them even did little guest appearances with the various ballet companies in their cities. Ultimately, it was more a gimmick kind of a thing where they could draw audiences and fill seats because they've got maybe Lynn Swan from the Pittsburgh Steelers, so he's showing up and doing a little appearance and so forth and something that they're doing. But ultimately, it was more so that they were taking these dance classes for strengthening, conditioning, flexibility. So my mom, being a wonderful mom that she is, she took me to the doctor because I had a knee injury from football. And from that knee injury, the doctor was like, well, I think that, you know, get him into some dance classes because pro athletes, they're taking dance classes. It helps strengthen his legs for him. So she got me in there, but I go back and come to find out I've got this genetic issue where I'm hyperextended in all four directions, both side to side and front and back with my knees. So he said you'd have to wear a halo around your knee to protect your knee in order to play football. Otherwise, you're going to end up not walking. So I had to make a decision between walking and dancing. And the first dance class I got into and got a chance to see that there was 30 very beautiful young ladies in there, at 15 years old, I think my decision was made really quickly for me that I'm going to go ahead and become a dancer. And I've been a dancer ever since, and definitely under the tutelage of Geraldine, who was very much like a mother to me. You know, I learned and was so fortunate to have gotten hooked up with her to meet and work with some of the top names in the dance business that, you know, I've just been a very fortunate individual. So, yeah, my beginnings are an interesting thing, and I always like to tell people that story because I like to encourage more young men to get involved with it, into dancing.
Tell me, what keeps you in Dayton, and why is SMAG Dance Collective important for the area?
You know, what keeps me here in Dayton is something that, you know, you always hear people talk about how Dayton is boring and there's nothing to do and there's all these things. And I sit there and I look at Dayton and I'm like, wow, there is so much to do here. It's just a matter of opening your eyes and opening your mind to it and going ahead and experiencing it. So Dayton's really a great place for an artist to be able to develop themselves, and also the cost of living. I mean, you can't beat it. If I were in New York, where I'm living at right now, I'd have to spend about $4,000 to $5,000 a month to live in a place like that. I think resources, there's some good resources, and I think that SMAG, as far as what we're doing, is good for the city of Dayton because, one, we're pushing the limits. You know, we're forcing other organizations to have to look at their collaborative efforts, you know, and start reaching out to other organizations and collaborate, which is good for audience members. It's like people to go to a buffet as opposed to going to getting a dinner at a singular restaurant. You know, if you could spend $10 and have a variety of choices as opposed to spending $20 and get a single choice of something, you know, most people are going to go for the $10 and a variety of choices, which is why buffets are so important. And I would say SMAG Dance, if you look at it in that kind of a light, is important to the community because it does provide that more bang for your buck opportunity that a lot of people, especially with today's current economic situation, would be looking for.
In the couple of minutes that we have left, you've got a Valentine's Day party and fundraiser coming up on Saturday, February 8th, and it's essentially a celebration of your 10 years.
Yes, it is. Oh, it's been a long 10 years. I never even thought we'd get this far. You know, there's been a couple times where I wanted to throw the towel in, but fortunately I've got some strong people around me that encouraged me to not give up and to keep focusing on the vision. And the Valentine's Day fundraising party that we're having is going to be held at Bricks, which is located on East 1st Street, right there across from 5th 3rd Field. They've been a very good source of assistance to help us with raising funds, and we're going to have like lots of games. There's going to be a dance contest. We're going to have a few people do some movement art as well. We'll also be doing some dancing ourselves in the event, and we're also going to have some prizes and raffle options that are going to be available. So it should be like a bazaar. It'll be a really nice kind of fundraising event and not your typical fair where you show up, have a few drinks, see some entertainment, and then leave. You know, this is really a part of like our mission where we really like to interact with the audience and the people that come to see us and get them involved.
And you've got other events coming up as well. If folks want information on those, they can visit you at smagdance.org. I've been speaking with Michael Grooms, founder and artistic director of Smag Dance Collective. Michael, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Jerry, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org, a community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. I'm Jerry Kenny, coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.